Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm your host, Travis, and today we're going to talk about what to do when you've matched or have a new job or your first job. What is next? So there's a lot of things to consider, which is why I thought it would be kind of fun to do a whole pod on this. Match day came and gone, and a lot of people now know where they're going for training. If you're a physician, congratulations. You know, there's, I think, an expanding pool of match days and, you know, making this a big life event. I mean, it obviously is in a lot of ways. You know, you train so hard, you work so hard, you finally find out, I'm going to this residency program, or I'm going to this fellowship program, or I'm getting this first job out of graduation, or I'm taking my first second job that I've had since I've graduated. So there's all these like big life events that often happen in the spring. And I thought we'd just talk about some of the different things that you might want to consider, you know, as you maybe go through one of these big life events. So the first thing is stop and smell the roses, right? Congratulations. This truly is a big event. Now, obviously, not everybody in the match system, because it's not something that you always get to choose. Sometimes this is a difficult time for some people, but in general, it's a really good thing, right? In general, most people are excited about moving along the journey. Obviously, you know, there are a lot of residents that match that we'll talk about today. I don't want to make this episode just that, though, because I do know that there's a lot of people out there that are not physicians that listen to this podcast, and you might be graduating and taking your first job, or you might be joining a PGY1 if you're pharmacist residency, or you might be doing your GPR residency if you're a dental student graduating, or you, again, might be taking, you know, your second job that you thought your first job was going to be great. It wasn't. So you're moving in onto your second job and you've signed a contract or something. So I thought I would just try to speak to that big group of people that, you know, is going through a big life event change with your profession in the coming months. So the first thought, since this is the Student Loan Planner Podcast, is let's talk about student loans. So you are getting a new job, right? What should you do with your income-based payments? Remember that you do not have to recertify your income unless it benefits you early. So you have your IDR recertification date. You know what that is. You know what you're going to have to produce at that date. You're going to have to show tax returns or alternative documentation of income. So who should try to recertify early? So if you are having a big jump in income, there's nothing special that happens by you trying to recertify right before you get this big jump in income. I wouldn't necessarily fool with that. I think that that can kind of just cause you needless anxiety, generally speaking. Usually when people take a job, they're having a pay bump, right? When you're changing your jobs, taking your first job, taking your second job, you're getting a pay bump, not a pay decrease. Now, if you were getting a pay decrease, go to studentaid.gov/IDR and go ahead and recertify to get a lower income-based payment, of course. But if you're not getting a pay decrease, if you're actually, you know, getting an increase in your pay, just use the system that exists with proving tax returns by automatically linking your stuff to the IRS to get yourself the lowest payment possible on your student loans. Now, of course, you might also be thinking, well, and this is to the folks that are taking their first high-paying job or second truly high-paying job in their career that might be wanting to refinance their loans. If you have a W-2, then you can refinance pretty easily. If you have a 1099, it's a lot harder. You got to have 2 years of good-looking tax returns to be able to refinance your loans. Now, a lot of people might say, why would I do that? Interest rates are 5.5%. My federal loans are 6.25%. I get it. But in general, rates might fall at some point, and you want to know that in terms of implications for what payment plan you might choose. So that's the loan stuff. That's not the fun stuff, really. That's stuff you just want to get out of the way so you can move on to the good stuff when you've matched or taken your first job or first, second job. Let's talk about the house. That is by far the biggest what should I do type of question when you have a big life transition, especially when you're, you know, in your mid-20s or mid-30s or late 30s, right? Because this is the time where a lot of people are forming households, you're starting a family, you just got married, you're in a long-term relationship. It can be really chaotic because a lot of times if you're not already married or engaged, you're in a long-term relationship, you find out where you're getting matched. It's time for that super serious, let's talk conversation about where are we going. I had it with my now wife, and I think a lot of people in the medical space have this conversation at one point or another where, okay, you've matched in a different city, which requires you to move, and your relationship is based in a different city. So is that person moving with you? That's a big what if. So I send good vibes towards anybody that has to have that conversation, hope it goes well, or hope it goes the way it's meant to be. But let's say you do have that stable relationship, or you know, you're engaged, long-term partner, you're married, and you're moving, and you're bringing that person's coming with you because you consider them part of the family unit. So should you rent or should you buy? I've got a interesting kind of rule of thumb for this, to think about this. So let's first of all say, well, how long is your training going to be? Are you doing, you know, a 3-year family medicine residency? Are you doing a 6+ year orthosurgery residency or something like that, or a neurosurgery residency? So that's one question. The shorter your residency, the less of a good idea it is to buy. Next question is how likely is it that you're going to want to stay in that area after you finish training? You know, if you are moving explicitly to a place during training or for your first job where you really want to end up no matter what, and you're willing to take huge salary sacrifices to do so, then yeah, maybe that leans a little bit more towards buying the house. How significantly is your income going to increase when you're done with training completely? If it's going to go way up, there's a good chance that you're going to want to buy a different house. And so that's a point towards renting and just enjoying like a lifestyle kind of apartment building while you're building up your time or waiting around to buy the house you want. And then also, what kind of stability do you want for your family? Do you want to have a place that is your place? You won't have to be constantly changing your address on your Christmas cards. Do you want to be in a place and have it be yours, be able to paint the house like whatever colors you want? Those are some of the considerations on house buying or not. Let me give you a couple other statistics to use on whether or not you want to buy a house in your first job or when you're starting residency or fellowship in an area. So you want to think about something called price to rent ratio. So you take the type of house that you would buy, and then you look at the rent, the monthly rent. And what you do is you take the purchase price of the house you would buy and divide it by the rent times 12. What is that ratio? So let's do some math. Let's say we've got a $500,000 house. And let's say, I'm going to really break up my calculator for this. It's big math here, guys. $500,000 house. And let's say you've got a $2,000 a month rent that house would rent for. So you're going to say 500,000 divided by 24,000, which is 2,000 times 12. And that number ends up being 20. So that's a price to rent ratio of 20. Now, let's compare this to if the rent was 3,000 a month for that house. So we'll do 500,000 divided by 36,000, and that's 13. And then let's say that you're in San Francisco, and let's say the house you want to buy is 1.5 million, and we're going to divide that by the rent, which let's say is 3,000 a month as well. That ratio is 41. So we've got three different ratios here from this math problem. We did the $500,000 house, the rent's for 2,000 a month. That ratio was about 20. We've got the $500,000 house that rents for $3,000 a month. So let's say it's a, you know, higher rent area. That ratio is 13. So 13, 20, and the San Francisco ratio is 41. So what does that mean? You know, this is just me talking, right? So what do these ratios actually mean? So the ratio of 13, the lower the price to rent ratio, the better it is to buy instead of rent. So for example, if you've got a really low price to rent ratio, what that's telling you is that the break-even period on owning a house in that particular locality is pretty quick. You break even on buying a home fairly quickly. So here's an example. You're doing a residency in middle of nowhere, Nebraska. There's not a bunch of tech executives trying to buy extremely fancy homes there. So what's probably likely is that price to rent ratio is going to be pretty low. And so you probably, you know, break even fairly quickly on a house in the middle of nowhere, Nebraska. Conversely, if you go to San Francisco and you look at the price to rent ratio out there, that ratio is going to be so high that you never break even on a house. It's always a bad decision, financially speaking, to own a house in a city like that. What is this ratio guideline? So if the price to rent ratio is below 15, pretty good idea to buy. If the price to rent ratio is 15 to 20, it's kind of a neutral signal. If the price to rent ratio is above 20, then it's better to rent instead of buy. So that's the financial aspect to it. What needs to happen is you need to think more about what do you want to do? What makes you happiest? What is important to you? And I think a lot of people buy a house in training because they think that it's the best idea, but it's actually not. So I think what you need to do is just reflect on what do you want? What do you want to experience? What do you want your training years to be like? Same question for your first job out of school. So when you move to an area, are you single? If you're single, I would wait on buying a house, because your spouse is probably going to have a lot of opinions about it, and you'll end up having to sell the one that you bought sooner than you expect, would be my guess. Now, if you're married and you go to a place where you've always wanted to be, sure, buying a house seems like a reasonable thing to do, and you don't necessarily have to wait. What matters a lot more about buying a house is buying one that has fairly low expected maintenance, It's one that your spouse or partner will be happy with. It's one that will not stress you out. And it's just one that is what you need and not a lot more than what you need. So a couple reasons why I say this. So if you buy an old house, get ready for some major maintenance. So we bought a house that the original owner lived in for 40 years, and it was a nightmare in terms of things that had to be updated. You know, the water main broke, the pipes we found out were rusted through, cast iron pipes, which you can't really know until you snake a drain and use it a bunch. And if we had known that, maybe we would have reconsidered buying the house. Obviously, overall, it was okay, but it was all of this stuff, you know, deferred maintenance that had not been done because it was an older house. In terms of buying a house that your partner or spouse is happy with, we did some major renovations on our house, and we probably could have done fewer renovations if we'd bought a more updated one. Now, in our case, it probably was the right decision to buy like an older, outdated house because, you know, my wife really wanted to update a lot of things, even on houses that were fairly newer, just because it didn't match her style, right? So you really want to have that hard conversation with your spouse to make sure that you're making a wise decision and you're not going to buy something that you're going to immediately want to go spend a ton of money in when you don't have it. For that situation where you are in an area temporarily, then it really is a little bit more of a math problem, right? Because if you're probably just going to stay somewhere for a little bit of time, then you're probably going to be turning around and selling the house anyway. So the question is that something that really matters all that much? Buying a house, another thing to think about is, let's say you are going to be in an area, let's say that it's your first job or your second job, and you're going to stick in an area for a little while. Do you think that there's any chance that you won't like the job? Or do you think there's any chance your job will ask you to move locations? So I'll give you an example. We bought a house in between my wife's two hospitals that she went to. And then 1 year in, I suggested, hey, let's put this off until we feel more confident about what hospital you're going to be asked to go to. Lo and behold, it was the pandemic. It was stressful. My wife was tired of living in an apartment. So we bought the house. And then the place where she worked dropped one of the hospitals and didn't have her go into that hospital anymore. So now we're, you know, instead of being in between the two hospitals that she had to serve, now we're farther than we need to be for that one hospital. No criticism. I think it's fine, whatever happens with your housing situation, but it's just stuff to think about, right? It's not you should do this, you should do that. It's just stuff to consider that a whole lot of times one of two things happen in your first job out of school or your second job change. You either discover, hey, I don't like this job, or hey, I don't like this area. That happens more than you think. And then you don't want to be stuck in your position because you stretched yourself to buy a house. On the flip side, a lot of people end up just liking where they're at and staying a while too. So you want to balance all those things out. So let's talk about contract negotiation, contract details. What is in your job contract that you are signing? So if you're a resident or a fellow, it is what it is. You don't have to worry about it, right? You're just going to sign your contract and it's just going to be pretty straightforward. Now, if you're taking a job at a school, your first job, or maybe your second job, a couple things to consider. So everybody says nothing's negotiable. It's not true. There's always something that you can negotiate over. It might not be salary. It might be something else. It might be protected time for research. It might be your non-compete. It might be vacation time. It might be benefits. It might be mentorship. It might be a whole lot of things. But generally speaking, unless you're dealing with a Harvard hospital kind of situation, Brigham and Women's, and it's just like, it is what it is. We never negotiate because we don't have to. And even then, those groups tend to be willing to negotiate on something besides salary, right? So pretty much the only type of job that won't budge on salary is usually like academic hospitals, right? Academic hospitals tend to be really hardcore about not wanting to increase their offers very much, but they still do a whole lot. And, you know, just because we have a ton of data, let me tell you something that's a little bit shocking. Men ask for money more than women do, and at least in our experience with student loan planner clients. Like, we see a disproportionate number of our male medical professionals asking for more money in contract negotiations than our female clients. We'd love that not to be the case. We'd love for our female clients to ask what you're worth and to not feel bad about it. It's okay to have that conversation and to be data-driven and transparent and, you know, but also don't necessarily ask for salary if that's not what you value too, right? What I want you, for you, is that you would get what you want out of your first position. And even if you're a resident or a fellow, you might still be able to like have conversations, right? About a little bit of like quality of life type of stuff. So don't feel like you can't talk about the contract. A lot of times, like, employers want you to not ask questions. I think that, you know, speaking from an employer's perspective, it's never fun getting asked these questions. It's not like you're like, oh, yay, like somebody asked for a higher wage or more vacation. Yay. Yeah, it's never like super fun to talk about this stuff. But every employer also understands that it's reasonable. And obviously, be reasonable in your asks. You know, if you're being offered 3 weeks vacation and you ask for 10 weeks vacation, well, you'd want to do that delicately, or you'd want to be careful how you ask it. Strategic, I should say, instead of careful. Another thing to think about with non-competes that I've seen a lot of is people will throw non-competes in something, and oftentimes it's not enforceable. There's also a big Federal Trade Commission case, I think, coming down at some point that'll rule on whether or not you're even allowed to have non-competes in contracts. I would be thinking about that carefully, specifically if I was a dentist or a veterinarian. So, you know, if you're in a big health system, it's scary. They make you sign a non-compete, and they have lots of lawyers, and they're all way better paid than the ones that you would hire. And so in those sorts of situations too, they probably are very resistant to changing those non-compete languages and contracts for large health systems. But for smaller, like mom and pop dental practices that are hiring you, or like even a regional DSO or a regional corporate veterinary group, I mean, they're going to be a lot more flexible because it's a smaller organization. It's more flat. It's not as bureaucratic. And so, you know, you could probably push back on something that you think is unreasonable. You know, what's reasonable? I mean, you have to make that decision. You know, if your plan is to open up your own dental practice in a couple of years and you're in a small town and there's a 20-mile radius and you're non-compete, hey, that doesn't fly, right? You want to be thinking, okay, what spot would I potentially put my dental practice in given this non-compete radius, and could this allow me to make a living? If not, then, you know, you need to push back. So for example, if you could find a perfectly reasonable location with a 10-mile radius, but not with a 20-mile radius, then you need to just say, hey, 20 is kind of large, and that's like the whole metro area, and I couldn't make a living at all unless I work for you. So that doesn't work for me. Can we do 10? Can we do 10 miles instead of 20 miles? So that's just something to think about in terms of contracts. Next is benefits. Let's talk benefits in terms of what you'd want to make sure you're careful about. For benefits, a lot of times people take a new job and you don't really know how to use all your benefits. So you might have a 401k, you might have PTO, you might have sick leave, you might have short-term, long-term disability, a little bit of life insurance, you might have medical and dental coverage. All these things are like, wow, this is so cool. This is why my mom and dad wanted me to be a professional so I could get all these cool benefits. I think that you just want to be thinking through, how do I actually use these? So if you're in residency or fellowship, you know, you'll have a 403b, you'll have, you know, your typical medical, dental sort of benefits. The real question is like, do I even participate in this stuff? I'm just a resident. I hear that all the time. I'm just a resident. Do I even need to do my 403b, or should I just do my Roth IRA? Generally speaking, if you're making more than $50,000 a year, which most residents are making 60 or 70, then you're in a 22% federal bracket. And then when you throw on income-based repayment, which is 10%, and then your state income tax, you're pretty much in a 40% bracket for anything you earn above $50,000 a year. In that case, a 403b pre-tax is the way to go, because if you do traditional IRA contributions, you're going to have to deal with like pro rata rule problems when you do backdoor Roth IRAs in the future. So it's probably better to go ahead and do the 403b, even if you're not going to get a match on it in residency and fellowship. Now, if it's your first job out, other things to think about on your benefits is, do you need to do dependent care FSA because you've got a child in daycare? Should you do a health savings account with a high deductible plan, because you want to have a triple tax advantaged best account ever in your future and when you retire? What kind of health plan should you choose? What kind of big expenses are you might have coming up? Might you have a child in the coming year? Might you have any, do you have any kind of like chronic conditions or medications you want to make sure your health plan covers? Those are all big things to think about when you take a new job. You do want to be a little intentional about what benefits you select. Sometimes you also have 457 plans, which are an additional 403b. That's like a second 403b. So you could do $23,000 to each one. That's pretty cool. That's like if you're a brand new attending in an academic hospital setting or university hospital. And then there's other types of benefits too, like 401ks at a regular small business, simple IRAs. A lot of veterinarians get offered those. So you just want to be thinking, what should I be doing with my benefits? What's smart to do with my benefits? A couple other things, and then we'll keep today's episode a little on the shorter side. Paperwork to keep track of. What types of paperwork do you want to make sure you have a record of? So let me give you an example. Anytime you have a contract, I would take a picture of that contract every page, even if it's kind of long. I would take a picture with my phone. I'd make sure it's backed up to iCloud or Google Photos, because you never know what you might need. And the reason I say that, I'll give you a real personal example here. During the pandemic, my wife got laid off. Pretty shocking, right? Never happens to surgeons. But the hospital system she was working at kind of panicked and laid her off because the financials weren't looking good. What happened is they gave her a letter essentially saying, you know, if you find another job within this period that we were, you know, basically there's a required notice period where they have to keep her employed while she's looking for a job. So if you find another job during this period, then our usual and normal requirements of you giving us notice are waived, and you can go get that new job without having to give us the 6 months notice we're supposed to give us normally, or something like that. And so I take pictures of all this stuff. Why? Because you never know when you might need it. Reason being is she got a new position. We were excited. Yay, we got a new position. Yay, during COVID, it was hard to find one in her specialty and the place we wanted to be. And then we got grief about her leaving her position. Why did that happen? Well, because the financial situation totally changed. Remember a pandemic? You know, in March, April, May, June of 2020, everybody thought the world was going to end in terms of like finances for, you know, healthcare, hospitals, employers, et cetera. And then it changed like on a dime in that summer. And then that summer, people got busier than ever before. And so, you know, essentially the environment that she was leaving from was a totally different environment when she got her notice that she was being laid off. They were like, hey, you have to give us notice. You have to stay here a certain amount of time before you leave. And it's like, wait a second, take a look at this contract. Let me show you this contract that you gave us that says specifically, if you find a different position anytime, you know, during this layoff period, we're allowed to leave without any notice at all. So if I hadn't taken a picture of that, we could have had a real serious problem on our hands and we could have gotten real stuck and not taken this new job when the old one was trying to hold on to us. Some of these academic medicine hospital contracts are absolutely nuts. Like, thoughts to a lot of you that have to sign them, because I mean, some of these things are just, I don't know, like a lot of it I feel like would be so easy to challenge in court if somebody was a really motivated, like, and represented by an attorney that just wanted to really go hard. I mean, it's really pretty interesting. Like, a lot of these hospitals, like, will put all kinds of weird stuff in contracts and you're just like, wow, I can't believe you can get away with that. But it is important to take pictures of things, right? Like your offer letter, your term of employment, what are the terms they can lay you off with? Because what happens is, if ever something happens and they don't follow what they said in the contract, now you have an enormous amount of leverage where you can use that to get severance. You can use that to get an extension of health insurance or something. You can also, you know, there's always negotiations that you can do. And it's only a problem if you're not reasonable about it. So if they say in the contract, hey, you've got to give a year's notice of being laid off, and they don't give you that year's notice, well, guess what? They're in the hook for a whole extra year of your salary. And yeah, you don't want to create a bad reputation about yourself and the profession. That makes sense, right? But at the same time, you could also use that as leverage and point to that and say, essentially, like, the way I read this, you owe me an additional year of salary. I don't want to be a pain in the butt or anything, but can you be flexible with me on my departure date? Or can you be flexible with me on a little bit of extra vacation as I, you know, transition? So just be thinking about what's the worst that can happen, and do things to protect yourself against the worst that can happen. Now, this is not as much, again, in residency and fellowship, but it is more so, you know, when you have your first job, when you're done with school or training. And a couple other things too. Don't accept being bullied during your training. Lots of our medical friends have been told in residency to lie about their hours, and they are threatened sometimes. Like, if you report the wrong hours, you know, or if you say you were working 110 hours a week, then you could risk us getting unaccredited and you have to redo your residency. That's just abuse is what it is. And when somebody's being abusive, it's not okay. You actually have a lot more powers than you realize, and there's a lot less repercussions than you realize. If you end up in a residency program that's not treating you correctly and it's not following the terms of what the residency program states it has to be, what consequences will there be? Yeah, you have all this student loans. You want to finish residency so you can get an attending job. But do you know how desperate some parts of the country are for physicians? So yeah, you might not be able to, you might have a harder time, you know, in the New York City metro if, you know, you create a stink in your residency program because they're working you way more hours than you agreed upon. But guess what? There's a lot of other places in the country besides New York City that you could get your first attending job at and then come back to New York City. I'm just throwing that out as an example, but don't let yourself be taken advantage of, beaten up, asked to work in bad conditions, right? Remember, with these IDR plans, it's wonderful insurance that protects you from having to put up with stuff. That's a really wonderful part about getting a student loan plan in general is once you know what you're doing with your student loans, you don't have to freak out about it anymore. Now you can live life like you would normally live it if you didn't have debt, right? If somebody is being an abusive boss, you can talk back to them and let them know what is and is not acceptable. It's called boundaries. You might literally have a conversation with your boss if it ever comes up. Hey, so-and-so, like, you're expecting a response from me during whatever hours that we're talking about. I'm not on call. And I want to understand what is an acceptable boundary during these periods. Now, there might not be, you might say, that's not okay. You can't have a boundary. It's my patient. You know, that's what my wife would say. It's my patient. I got to hear about it no matter when, what time of night it is. So that's okay. If that's your choice, then it's your choice, right? That's okay. As long as it's your choice, as long as you're not being sort of bullied into doing something that you shouldn't have to do, I think it's important. I think it's important to hear that and to, again, like boundaries are okay. Now, boundaries, if you have boundaries with a job might also use their boundaries to say, okay, you're out. Like, but that's very rare. You know, and it usually only happens when that pushback is like something that they can't be okay with or something. So let's talk about insurance now. What kind of insurances do you need to get or look at when you are in this situation where you have this big life event, you have a change that's happening? One certainly big thing that is needed that you need to think about is malpractice insurance is generally like something you don't have to worry about. Like if you're taking a big hospital job or you're in residency fellowship, something like that, you generally don't have to worry about the malpractice stuff. If you're taking a W-2 job, you know, you're generally included in your practice's malpractice policy, but you could still ask the question. In terms of other insurances, I would certainly, you know, you're a quote unquote doctor with a target on your back in terms of, I don't know, you rear end somebody, they're fine, they take a picture of your license, et cetera, and then they look you up on Google and they say, oh, wow, so-and-so is a physician, they might have some money, I'm going to go get a lawyer to represent me and say that I have a nerve damage in my neck or something like that. I don't know, I'm just throwing out some like whatever like bad scenario I can think of that's not catastrophic in my head. But why would you want to go get your auto policy injury limits increased, your liability limits increased? Because of that reason, right? So, you know, whatever your max auto policy limits are, get those. If you have an umbrella liability policy in place, you should get one of those as well. Maybe like $1 million of coverage or something. You generally want that to be $1 million of coverage or whatever your assets are, whatever's greater. Is it a waste of money to spend $300 a year to get $1 million of coverage in an umbrella policy? I don't think so, because then somebody else is on the hook, the insurance company, and wants to provide you with lawyers in case somebody does the fender bender and wants to sue you for much money. So get those types of insurances in place. Homeowners, same kind of thing if you bought a home. Renter's insurance policy, I mean, I don't know. Renter's insurance policies, they're cheap. You might as well get one, I guess, if you're renting. And then the bigger, most important policy to get, if you're especially if you're starting training, is you want to get an own occupation disability insurance policy. So that own occupation disability insurance policy is something that generally will cost probably $100 to $300 a month, depending on your situation and your health conditions. What that does is it locks in a cheap rate in training, and then it allows you to buy more later without a medical exam. The reason why that's really helpful is, you know, you buy the policy, you become disabled, then you would not be able to get a policy at all. So even though it's kind of a low risk, it's still not a zero risk. And the liability that the insurance company is on the hook for is the very largest at the very beginning of the policy, because they have to pay you out until 65. So that's something that's real smart to get in place as soon as possible, is that own occupation disability insurance policy. And generally speaking, an ethical agent is going to look at what you can get in the private individual marketplace, like as an individual policy that you purchase, and compare that to what, if anything, that your hospital or residency program can offer. And sometimes residency hospital programs offer something called a GSI policy, guaranteed standard issue. What it means is that you're guaranteed to get coverage even if you have a medical condition, basically. But the catch is you can't have applied already with an individual policy and submitted quotes. Otherwise, that could invalidate your GSI eligibility. And so what happens is like an ethical agent will just submit the quotes no matter what without having a conversation about it if they see any issues or red flags before they submit it. And that can be really damaging, especially to somebody who could have gotten coverage that now can't get coverage, right? Sometimes the pricing is better on the individual policies. The individual policies sometimes beat those GSI policies, and then a lot of people don't even have access to a GSI policy. I'm throwing out some of the stuff that probably sounds very confusing. Maybe you've heard it before in a lunch and learn or something that people talked about, but if you need to get a new quote on own occupation disability insurance or you want to get your existing coverage reviewed, this is for all professions, not just physicians and dentists, pharmacists, veterinarians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, anybody that could have a six-figure income probably needs own occupation disability insurance. And if you could ever have a six-figure income, you probably need to get it as soon as possible. And, you know, I think the soonest you can get it, I think, is maybe third or fourth year of school, but don't quote me on that. I know you can definitely get it when you're in training or you have your first job. So if you need a coverage review, submit that quote request at studentloanplanner.com/quote. Pretty easy to remember. studentloanplanner.com/quote, because we actually have an insurance agency that does own occupation quotes all day called SLP Insurance. And it's called some other things in a few other states that require a different name. But SLP Insurance, we've got an in-house team now, or we brought that in-house recently. And so that's pretty exciting that we can help you out if you need that. So why did I mention own occupation disability and before the term life insurance that you might need? The own occupation disability is more important because you could still be here with us and be disabled and still need income. Whereas the term life, by definition, you're not here with us anymore. And therefore, you only need that if you have dependents or somebody depending on your income. Disability is also a lot more likely to happen than you dying. So disability happens, I think I've heard, in like 1 in 4 people in the course of their careers. Whereas death, luckily, during a person's career, since most of us retire and enjoy golden years and then die, death happens very infrequently for people that are actually working in a career. That's why own occupation is actually more important. I also say this is also very important for relationship security. So if you have two people in a relationship, if heaven forbid you were to become disabled, that is often a reason why relationships split apart. It's not because always, you know, the person doesn't want to be with you because you're disabled, but it causes a lot of stress, right? There's a lot of stress involved. It can really tear at a marriage and a relationship. You don't want to be financially vulnerable in that situation too. So that's why you want to make sure that you've got coverage for a lot of reasons, just to give yourself protection. You don't have to worry about it. That means you basically have a downside protection level that unless you develop a substance addiction, you're good on your income basically no matter what. It's pretty powerful, right? If you're anything in the medical space or legal space or high skilled corporate space, if you have that downside protection as somebody who's just entering the field, then it's all upside. All you have to do is not fumble the ball. You have the football on the 20-yard line, you got to kick the field goal to win it. All you got to do is not fumble and you win. So last thing to mention is lifestyle inflation. So you've just got into, you know, you've matched, you've got your first job out of school, you got your, you know, your second job that you're more excited about than your first, and you want to celebrate, you want to do something big with this extra money that you have now. There's actually something in economics that suggests that that's a good idea. It's called consumption smoothing, particularly for people that are expected to have much higher incomes after a short period of time earlier in their careers. There's something called marginal utility. Marginal utility is how much, the way I would describe it is, how much bang do you get out of each dollar you spend? How much bang for your buck do you get? So if you make $20,000 a year, another $1,000 is going to make a huge difference in your life. If you make $400,000 a year, an extra $1,000 does not make that much of a difference in your life. Same thing is true for residents that would become attendings. If you make $60,000 a year, an extra $1,000 makes a huge difference. Whereas if you make $200,000 a year, an extra $1,000 doesn't make that big of a difference. What that suggests is that you should borrow from the future to enjoy life more today if you are in one of these stepwise function income types of careers. That's exactly the opposite of what personal finance personalities like Susie Orman or Dave Ramsey would suggest, but that's okay because their advice is sort of like very emotion-driven in my opinion, right? It's very emotion-based and it sort of makes people emotionally hate their debt. If you look at the math, the reason these strategies of being super anti-debt work so well is just because it convinces you to not spend money. Instead of, nobody is going to probably take the $10,000 they would have spent on Disney World and put it into their brokerage account versus, you know, it's a lot easier to say, well, I can't go to Disney because I got to pay down my debt. Everything has to go towards my debt, right? So it's really an emotion-driven thing, this idea of like pay down your debt at all costs versus pay a lot less and invest instead. But I just want to encourage you that if you, you know, if you have a big life event that's happened, life is short, mental health is extremely important. You don't want to blow your money and be irresponsible. But a lot of times people beat themselves up for purchases that are entirely reasonable and responsible, and they shouldn't. So if you want to go out to eat and eat some $100 caviar from Whole Foods with a party at home with friends, you want to buy a $50 bottle of wine, you want to take a lavish vacation somewhere you've always wanted to visit, and you're worried about, well, I'm going to have a little bit of credit card debt in residency. Well, the question is not, should you have that or not? The question is how much? And what's an amount that's responsible versus not responsible? I would actually view somebody with $10,000 of credit card debt in residency who has an occupation disability insurance as someone who is a lot more responsible than somebody who has $10,000 in their emergency fund and no disability insurance. Why? Because that disability insurance gives you that floor of protection where you know you're going to be able to get rid of whatever credit card debt you have. Now, notice I said $10,000 and not like $100,000, right? Don't go out and get $100,000 of credit card debt. That's a bad idea. But in general, I think we need to be a little bit more graceful to ourselves and say, okay, I've just achieved this big thing. I've just found out where I'm going to work for my first job. I just found out where I got matched into for residency and fellowship. I just found out where I'm going to be going to my second job, and I'm really excited about it. And it is okay to increase your lifestyle and your spending some. The big thing that will torpedo you, though, is buying a gigantic house because it's exponential in terms of the costs of that house. So you have, for example, what are some of the costs? Well, you've got, you know, property taxes, maintenance, insurance, filling the house with furniture, fixing whatever's broken is exponential to the size of the house, utilities, decorations, right? I could go on and on. So really where people in this, I've seen this in thousands of consultations personally, where people really get themselves into trouble is when you do this level up in your career or your life in terms of your occupation, and you reward yourself with some like extremely top end of what you can afford house, which then cascades into a bunch of other things that that house needs, and suddenly you're house poor. So if it's anything besides that, or maybe I'll also add like a luxury car purchase, like probably be careful about that. Maybe buy 3 years used if you've absolutely got to have the electric Mustang or something. Can you find a one-year-old used Mustang instead if you absolutely have to have it? So I think that you want to be balanced. You want to be reasonable. You want to be pragmatic. You don't want to be able to say that you're part of the rice and beans bumper sticker club. I mean, I think that that's kind of not a good way to live a balanced life. It's a good way to have a marketing empire, in my opinion. Be reasonable, celebrate, enjoy your new status in life, your new sort of step along the journey. It is a journey. You want to enjoy it. You don't want to be thinking, oh gosh, like if only I can get through this. That's not a good way to live life. So if you're in that kind of feels, then you got to figure out a way to reward yourself or go to therapy or something to get yourself through this and into a place where you can enjoy or find some parts that are enjoyable about whatever season you're at in life. But again, for all the folks out there who've recently matched or found out where they're working for the first time after after school, congratulations. Let me say it to you again. Congratulations. I'm proud of you. We're all proud of you at Student Loan Planner. Now, if you need help with any of the stuff we talked about in today's show, if you need help with the student loan aspects of things, there's a ton of stuff you can do in training or right out of school to keep your payments low that a student loan consult would more than pay for itself. Optimizing things like timing of consolidation, whether you should do extensions on your taxes, whether or not you should do joint or separate for your tax filing status, when you should do save or do a plan that's got a payment cap. So if you're going to have a really high income later, maybe you need to be on a plan with a payment cap instead of the save plan, which has no payment cap. So if you need that kind of service, studentloanplanner.com/book, get a student loan consult. Now, if you want all-encompassing help about student loans, but also everything else we talked about today, housing, contracts, benefits, insurances, what you should be buying next and how much can you spend on it, that's financial planning. We also have that service. That's slpwealth.com/book, slpwealth.com/book. And if you haven't done a student loan consult before, if you use that link, you'd be prompted to do that first. studentloanplanner.com/book if you want a consult, slpwealth.com/book if you want that full service financial planning. Thank you all for listening to today's show. If you have any feedback or you want to leave any kind of comments or you want to record some questions, reactions to this pod, you can go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail and then just record a quick question that we'll answer on a future show. Thank you all for listening. Have a wonderful rest of your week.